The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
As Linda said, in case you couldn't hear her, my name is Andrea Fella, and I've been teaching here this past month while Gil has been away. This is my last Sunday that I'm teaching. So I want to just express my appreciation for your being here and attending and participating in this class. Some people have asked where I teach. And mostly I teach here. I am the main teacher for the Thursday night class here. So I just wanted to let you know that. So in the past month on Sundays, I've been talking about wisdom teachings of the Buddha, and I've in particular talked about the Four Noble Truths and about understanding what is skillful and what is unskillful in our behavior and in our mental activity. Today I'm going to talk about some insights that result from this path of practice. There's a teaching in one of the suttas that says, for one possessed of wise understanding, or essentially for one possessed of wisdom, it is impossible for that person to see things as permanent, as satisfactory, and as self. So this is essentially saying that someone who deeply understands the wisdom teachings of the Buddha, not just intellectually, but in a experiential way, that they will see into experience as being impermanent, unsatisfactory, and not self. These three are often called the three characteristics or three general characteristics of experience. That the Pali terms are often used here, so I will say those now. Impermanence is anicca. Unsatisfactoriness is dukkha. And not self is anatta. So anicca, dukkha, anatta. They're often mentioned in conjunction with each other. So these three insights, or essentially ways of perceiving our experience as unsatisfactory, as impermanent, as not self, essentially represents the insight or the understanding that comes through this practice. The term for insight meditation, or vipassana, means seeing clearly. The pasana part of vipassana means seeing clearly, and the V part means, as one of my Burmese teachers told me one day, various things. And he declared then that these various things in particular were seeing clearly into impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self. On the first Sunday when I talked about wisdom, I mentioned that a little bit of wisdom goes a long way when we allow that wisdom to kind of filter through us, and then we use mindfulness to meet our experience. But as we use mindfulness to meet our experience, these wisdom teachings of the Buddha become clear. And this teaching on impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self is no exception. So it is an expression of the insights that happen, but it also describes it orients us to a way of seeing things that we don't usually see, in ways that we don't usually see them. So mindfulness, as I said, is kind of the key to understanding this wisdom. The instructions, the basic mindfulness instructions, are to pay attention to your experience and notice kind of the specific qualities that we experience. Pressure, heat, tension, tightness, tingling, heaviness, lightness, vibration, particular form and color if you're seeing through, if you're seeing a pitch and tone if you're hearing, so that we begin to connect with the bare experience, the kind of just raw data coming into our experience, coming into our sense doors. That's the first part of the instruction in our mindfulness practice. The second part of the instruction is to notice what happens to our experience as we pay attention to it. So the first part of the instruction, beginning to notice the bare, raw experience, hones and sharpens our mindfulness so that we can more and more clearly see what's happening in the present moment. The second part, noticing what happens as we pay attention, begins to introduce us to these three aspects of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, and not self. In the present moment, these three experiences, the perception of these three become clear to us. They become obvious to us as we pay attention in a sustained, continuous way. We can try, and sometimes we do try, to direct our attention to observing impermanence, perhaps. But often what happens as we turn our attention to try to observe impermanence is more that what we're really experiencing is our idea of it than the direct experience of it. And that's not necessarily a problem, but it is very important to be able to recognize the difference between the direct experience of these characteristics and our experience through the idea of them. When we have the direct experience of them, that's what's called insight. And often that comes as something of a surprise. The experience of insight comes as something of a surprise. They become blindingly clear to us in the present moment. Sometimes one or another of these characteristics is more obvious to us. We perceive one or another of these aspects of experience more clearly than the others. So I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about each one of them. Impermanence, anicca. This is not a surprise to us. Everybody knows this. But we don't really deeply know it. There's one ancient Indian story called the Mahabharata, in which one of the characters in this story is asked, "What is the greatest wonder?" And here's his response. "This, I think, is most wonderful, that the man of the world, even though he is seeing before his eyes constantly creatures dying and passing away, never for a moment the idea enters him, 'I too have to fall. I am also a creature destined to be destroyed.' Even if it is told to him, it never enters his mind. Only the surface mind understands the language, but the actual sense never goes into his head. That every man must one day die, yet every man lives as if they were immortal. This is the greatest wonder." So we all know things are impermanent. We see the change of seasons. We see babies get born and aging into teenagers, adults. We age, we get sick, we die. We see our parents dying, children dying, friends dying. Our possessions deteriorate, our bodies deteriorate. This is kind of the obvious level of impermanence. It's easily perceptible to our senses. Yet, as was pointed out in that quote that I mentioned, the surface mind understands, but the deeper implication of it doesn't really enter our minds. I was listening to the radio on the road one day and heard a commercial that said something like, "We all know things are impermanent." And my ears perked up. And then it went on to say, you know, our possessions, you know, get lost, and we, you know, that vacation is no longer there, and it just went on to list of a few things. But then it said, but our memories, those are lasting. Our memories are permanent. So buy this jewelry to commemorate your memories. So the memories, yes, exactly. So the memories are also fleeting. Now, we think of them as being sometimes continuous, so that we have access to them until we have Alzheimer's, until we have brain injury. Or the actual one thing I noticed at one point, I had a long relationship, and then that relationship ended, and all of the beautiful memories became very painful memories. So the context changed and the memories became painful. After working through the suffering of that relationship, the memories are back again. They're not painful anymore. So the memories change, our relationship to memories change. And in fact, the changing, the mind is actually changing much more quickly than is apparent. And I'll go into that in just a moment. In terms of this obvious level of impermanence, probably the most powerful reflection that we can make along these lines to incline our minds towards understanding impermanence is to reflect on death. To reflect on our own death, our own mortality, to reflect on the mortality of others, of our friends, of our families. At one point, Carlos Castaneda was having a gathering of some friends, and one woman was there who said, "I just don't understand how to have a spiritual life." And he recommended to her, reflect on the fact that of all your friends, of your children, of your husband, your parents, they will all die, you will die, and you do not know in which order they will die. You will soon have a spiritual life. Now, this reflection does not need to be depressing. Really, what it can do is to open us to the beauty of life, of the preciousness of life. This reflection can actually open our hearts, and we can connect more deeply to our experience and to our in our relationships. Another quote from one of Carlos Castaneda's early books. He asked his teacher, Don Juan, this same question. He thought it was basically useless to dwell on death, since such a thought would only bring discomfort and fear. And Don Juan says, "Death is the only wise advisor that we have. When you feel that everything is going wrong and you're about to be annihilated, turn to your death and ask if that is so. Your death will tell you that you're wrong, that nothing really matters outside of its touch. There's a strange, consuming happiness in acting with the full knowledge that whatever you are doing may very well be your last act on earth. I recommend that you reconsider your life and bring your acts into that light." It's a very powerful teaching to really take in our own mortality. It's staring us in the face, this teaching, and we do not take it in. There is a more subtle level of this teaching of impermanence. And this is that our experience is actually changing incredibly rapidly. It takes a pretty settled mind to be able to see this. In our mindfulness meditation, we pay attention to our experience. We bring our attention to the breath, for example. And the more we can stay with the breath and be continuous with the breath, the more we can direct our attention and just hang out with the experience of breathing. If we turn our attention to the instruction around what happens to the breath while you're breathing, what happens to the experiences while you're breathing, as the attention gets continuous, the mind starts to perceive more and more rapid changing experience in the breath. There are many, many different sensations in the in-breath. There's a very clear beginning to the in-breath, a very clear changing nature during the in-breath, and a very clear ending of the in-breath. When the mind is really quiet and settled, actually seeing an in-breath come into being and an in-breath disappearing can be shocking. That's that recognition of impermanence in the moment. That as we start to connect more deeply with our experience, we begin to understand our assumption of impermanence as what we're observing suddenly disappears. And we really clearly see, wow, there it's gone, immediately vanishes in an instant in front of our eyes. No experience lasts for very long. Our body sensations are impermanent. Our thoughts are impermanent. Our emotions are impermanent. Things are changing extremely rapidly. Look for yourself and you'll see the truth of this. It's not necessary for you to believe that experience is changing very rapidly. Simply follow the instructions of the mindfulness. Connect to your experience. Notice it as closely as you can and observe how it changes. If you find something that seems to be solid and unchanging, look more closely. The second aspect or way that we perceive our experience through this insight is unsatisfactoriness, dukkha, often translated as suffering. This is the recognition that the things and experiences that we hold on to won't ultimately make us happy. This is a logical outcome of impermanence. Here's a quote from one Buddhist scholar, Karuna Dasa is his name. Dukkha is but a logical corollary arising from this law of universal impermanence. For the impermanent nature of everything can lead to but one inescapable conclusion. As everything is impermanent, they cannot be made the basis of permanent happiness. Whatever is transient is by that very fact unsatisfactory. But the way we look for happiness, the way we've been trained to look for happiness in our life, the way we assume happiness comes, is through getting things that we want. I talked about this quite a bit a few weeks ago when I talked about the Four Noble Truths. So I won't go into great detail here. But we have this belief that getting what we want is what makes us happy. And it does make us happy for a moment or two, or maybe a week or two, or even a month or two. But it's not a lasting happiness. It's not what ultimately will satisfy us. What we find is that happiness fades, and then we're off with this kind of wanting feeling of what's the next thing that will make me feel that way again? And we just end up in a cycle of wanting to find the next thing that will make us feel that way. This teaching on unsatisfactoriness is this beginning to recognize very clearly in our experience that trying to hold on to things that are impermanent will make us suffer. It's the letting go that brings the releasing that brings a kind of happiness that's not the result of having something, but of releasing, of letting go. Again, there's a subtle level to this. When we start to see clearly in our meditative experience how we hold on to things and how that holding on itself is what creates this feeling. It's what causes this unsatisfactoriness. If we don't hold on to things, there's no fear that they will disappear. If we are balanced around the unfolding of the life of impermanence, there's an ease in relaxation in just letting go. Sometimes in our meditation, it's very clear to us that we're holding on to something and we don't know how to let go. I've experienced this at times in my meditation. I can feel the suffering of holding on to a belief or holding on to a wanting to get rid of a pain. And I know deeply in my experience, if I could let go of that resistance, I would not be suffering as much. But I have no idea how to let go. It's like the mind itself is just contracted around that experience and not really able to release. And this is actually part of our practice. It's the understanding of this suffering that the mind creates. This understanding. And we start to see that as we just understand, as we allow ourselves to understand suffering, it's the doorway to the release from suffering. That as we hang out with our suffering, there's a little bit of space around it. A little bit. The insight around unsatisfactoriness has to do with, as the mind has seen over and over again, that holding on. It sees itself as doing that holding on, it begins to understand its own participation. The mind begins to understand its own participation in the suffering. And as it sees itself start to reach out to something, it recognizes that way lies suffering. And it just doesn't hold on. So it's more of something that happens through a natural process of letting go, more than being something that we do. That letting go of things that we're holding on to. A letting go of a belief that happiness comes from just getting more and having things one after another. It comes from understanding the suffering that we land in. And the mind begins to understand itself how to let go. It's not something we can actually do. The mindfulness brought together with our experience teaches us how to let go. The third aspect, or third way of perceiving our experience, is as unsubstantial or as not self. And this is the characteristic of anatta. This is often hard for people to kind of grasp this concept, because we all have this very strong view of ourself. It's like the air we breathe almost. It's just there. It's so obvious to us that we are a self. And that is the way we view our experience. And so all of our information coming into us confirms that experience, confirms that we have a self. Essentially, our hypothesis produces the results that we believe. So I'm just going to take you through a few things to help perhaps open your minds to this possibility. So there's kind of an ordinary level of this aspect of not-self. At one point, you were all 2 years old. Where is that self that was 2 years old? Changed through a process of aging. There's some sense of continuity that we have because of memory. That I think is partly how we construct ourselves, is through this thread of memory, through this telling ourselves our story of me over and over again. Through talking to ourselves about what we did yesterday and what we did last week and what we plan to do tomorrow. So there's this sense of continuity. Now, this sense of continuity results from a not clearly seeing how rapidly things are changing. This characteristic of anatta refers to the ephemeral nature of existence. Everything we experience is a flux. It's a process. It's not to say there's nothing there, but there's a process happening, and there's nothing that lasts for even a split second. Everything is in such a, this is very deeply connected to impermanence. Everything is such a rapid process of change that it's like a mist or a vapor. It's vanishing even as it comes into being. It's like a magic show, an illusion created by not seeing the rapidity of change. So an example for this that you can all kind of connect to is like if you go to a movie, you know what's happening. Well, I don't know in digital form now what it's like, but like we all knew what it used to be was individual still frames. And I'm sure it's something similar in the digital world. That there are these individual still frames. and that they were being projected at such a fast rate that it looks like there's movement going on. It looks like there's something happening. It's the rapidity of change that creates that illusion of something actually being there. One way that helps me to distinguish between, to make a distinction between the perception of impermanence and the perception of not self. In the perception of impermanence, there, and in the insight of impermanence, at least in my experience, there's the sense of there being something there, and that it comes into being and then it disappears. But it feels like there's something there. In the perception of anatta, of unsubstantiality, it doesn't even feel like there's anything there. It is just such a rapid flux that there's nothing even created. So everything is just vanishing even as it comes into being. So there's some evidence for not self that we overlook because we have this perception of self. We see our experience through this view of self. And it happens to us all the time. Just for instance, when you sit down to meditate, you make the choice to try to stay in the present moment, to pay attention to your breathing. Feels like something you've chosen to do. And what happens? Your mind wanders. Who did that? Who wandered? If you had chosen to stay, you would have stayed. So there's some process happening, some process of causes and conditions that led to that consequence of the mind wandering. And even more amazing is that after wandering off for some time, you wake up again. Oh, here I am. Who did that? Who created that coming into being of awareness? It's purely spontaneous. That moment of waking up, recognizing, oh, here I am again, is a wonderful moment of a place where we can really touch into this characteristic of not self. It's a great place to explore in your meditation. Take some interest in that moment of waking up. What we usually do is beat ourselves up and miss this opportunity to see this evidence for not self. You didn't even have a choice. You're beating yourself up, and you didn't even have a choice that you wandered, and you didn't have a choice that you come back, but then we beat ourselves up. Another way of exploring this is through beginning to look at kind of the conditioned nature of our experience. This takes a little bit more subtlety of mind to begin to look at our intentions, why we do things. So a place to play with this is in changing postures. If you can catch the moment before you change your posture, if this is possible, you can know you're going to do something before you do it. So if you can catch that moment before you stand up, for instance, you might notice that there's a reason why you're going to stand up. So that's the intention, or that's the motivation for the standing. The standing hasn't come into being out of nothing. It's come into being because there's been a motivation for it. And that motivation has actually come into being because there's been a motivation for that. So for instance, you're sitting at your computer and you've been sitting there for a while and you get thirsty. So the fact of you're sitting there for a while has been the creation of the condition for thirst to arise. And then forms an intention to get a drink of water. That's arisen because of the thirst. And then forms the intention to move, because in order to get the water, you have to move. So you stand up. It's all just causes and conditions. Intention, action, intention, action, intention, action. When you start to witness and actually pay attention to your intentions, you begin to really clearly see there's no one doing these things. It's simply choices. Choices are made. It's not that choices aren't made. Choices are made either out of habits of mind, sort of the habitual tendencies of our mind, the way we've chosen things in the past, or if we're mindful, there may be an opportunity for some wisdom to make the choice. A lot of people express a kind of a fear around this teaching of not self. That there's a sense of going to be losing something, or a feeling of like just not being grounded somehow if there's no me. They feel like, people often say to me, well, I understand impermanence. That's not a problem. That's no big deal. But in my experience, actually, impermanence is a really frightening thing. When we see when you really understand how unstable experience is, that can be a scary experience. When you see that there's no one there to actually worry about things or choose things or do things or experience things, that it's simply choosing, doing the choosing, experiencing, doing the experiencing, doing the doing, it's a relief. It's a huge relief. Joseph Goldstein sometimes gives an analogy around this, that the practice is kind of like, you know, jumping out of an airplane. That, you know, you jump out of the airplane, you know, think you've got a parachute on, and you jump out, and, you know, at first you're just kind of falling, and that's okay. And then, you know, it's like you go to open your parachute, and it's like you don't have a parachute. There's not even a parachute there. And so this huge fear arises, because there's this sense that there's no safety net. And then you realize that there's no ground. All there is just continual flow and change and falling in perpetuity. So these insights become clear by simply paying attention. They're not something you actually need to believe. This can be just an orientation. Let this just go in to your thoughts. You can kind of at times think about orienting yourself to looking at one or the other of these things. But really the teaching is to pay attention, as I said at the beginning, pay attention to your experience. Let your mindfulness contact your experience and notice what happens to it. That's all you need to do. These teachings will reveal themselves. As one teacher put it, enlightenment is an accident. Meditation makes us accident prone. So it's time to stop and to move into our potluck. So thank you all for your attention.